The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. I'm looking at the live stream right now on YouTube. Some nice little knickknacks behind me, a bookshelf, and some other things. So we're dressing it up just a little bit. Looks nice and warm. I was telling the guys I need my sweater. I need to be able to walk in here and either put on my sweater, take off my sweater, whatever it is. But it's great to be back with you. It's been a busy, busy, busy weekend. I've forgotten how busy the graduation weekend is here. In Edmond, I've been at the Edstone graduation the last few years. And, of course, over at Edstone, the graduation's at 9 p.m. It's the live stream between the two campuses. So at 9 p.m., once the ceremony's over, then we don't stay around too late just because of how late the ceremony itself is. But here it's 3 in the afternoon, and before that you've got the grad brunch, and before that you've got the special Sabbath weekend, all the visitors in town, quite a few family members, not as many as we would have liked. There's still some travel restrictions, especially for those coming in from overseas. But we did have quite a few visitors here from the United States, and that was great to see that. And, of course, very special to see the graduates yesterday, 23 seniors, 23 sophomores. And for us, as I said yesterday, that's pretty big. It's, of course, by worldly standards, it's very, very small, God's College. But it's great to see the impact that Herbert W. Armstrong College has had on the work and even on the world these past 19 or 20 years that the college has been in action. Speaking of the work, over the weekend over in the UK, we had the program Redemption Draws Near. That brought in 170 requests. So we were happy to see some pretty good numbers from the UK for the TV program there. Coming up on today's program, as we typically do, I gave the commencement here in Edmond yesterday, and we'll be playing that commencement address for the second half of the program. So if you missed that yesterday, I know some people were able to see the live ceremony on PCOG.org, but if you missed that, you can hear the commencement address coming up on the second half of today's program. Well, I've mentioned before this book by Daniel Boorstin, The Image, A Guide to Pseudo-Events in America. And the first half of this book really is about how the news media has changed so dramatically over the past 50 or 60 years. In fact, this book is pretty old. I think he wrote it back in the 1960s. So if he was around today to see what the media are doing, what they get away with on a daily basis, it's all about a carefully staged image. And so much of the time, it's completely phony, or as the president says, it's fake. It's not even real. It's just this fictitious staging. That's all that matters. If it's framed just so, that's what they want for you to see in a Friday press conference. This was Caitlin Collins. She works for CNN. And you can hear her at the start of this clip kind of barking out to the president. You know, I notice some of the doctors behind you are wearing face masks, and then some people aren't, including, of course, the president. And here's how the president responded to her question. Clip one.
Mr. President, could you just clarify, why are some of you wearing a mask and why are some of you not wearing a mask?
We've all been tested. I've been tested. We've all been tested, and we're quite a distance away, and we're outdoors. So I told them, I gave them the option. They could wear it or not. So you can blame it on me, but I gave them the option. We could wear it or not.
President's response. We've been tested. Look, I told them you can wear a mask if you like. It's not mandatory. But for Miss Collins, and you can see this from her Twitter feed, she gives us daily updates on who's wearing a mask, who isn't wearing a mask. She wants the public to know. I mean, she's working for CNN. So We've got to know who's wearing a mask. And of course, you see it in the president every day. He doesn't wear one. Now, he visits a factory, and if he wears goggles, that's big news. That's big news because he didn't have the face mask. Why would he wear the goggles? That could make for a whole 30-minute segment on CNN. So here is the same reporter. I didn't have time this morning to check if this was on the same day, because this was with the press briefing with the White House press secretary. And it was right at the end of the briefing. You had the same reporter, Caitlin Collins. She's there on the front row of the White House briefing room. And then she gets up. I'll show you about 10 seconds of it. There's really no sound with it. But she gets up from the briefing and immediately pulls off her mask and then starts walking next to people in the press briefing room. Within just the clip you just heard from President Trump, he's outside. They're all spread out. They're meters apart. And she can't believe he doesn't have a mask on. And then here she is inside in the briefing room. As soon as the cameras are off, or so she thought, then she pulls off the mask. Here's clip two. So you can see her there in the pink coat as she passes by a few people in the briefing room and pulling off her mask before she does that. So the president tweeted out after this video went viral. He said, a CNN faker. She's faking. Is she really, really concerned about the health and the safety of the general public, including her own fellow reporters? Or is she more concerned about the image, the pseudo event that when the cameras are rolling, you're supposed to have the mask covering your face? When the cameras are off, then you can take off the mask, no problem. She responded to the president's tweet. He called her a faker. And she pulled out this. This is their ace in the hole. This is all they have. Nearly 90,000 Americans have been killed by coronavirus, and the president is tweeting about me pulling my mask down for 6 seconds on Friday. She just did it for 6 seconds in the presence of all her fellow reporters. That's the Stelter defense. How do you even bring up General Flynn and the fact that he was entrapped, the fact that he was set up? We don't have time for that. 90,000 people. 90,000 people. Quit talking about the Russia probe. Say the people who talked about the Russia probe for 3 straight years, nonstop. 90,000 people. That's the new Russia probe for the left-wing media. It's all about the image. And when the cameras are off, then you can pull off the mask. Then you can go to the Washington cocktail parties. Then you can socialize. Then you can have fun. When the cameras turn on again, well, then you can really criticize the red states, people going to beaches in Florida or California or wherever. Carefully, carefully staged. This is from Politico last week. Now, about a month ago, Politico, that's a left-wing organization too. And about a month ago, they were really piling it on Florida. Florida was going to be a disaster, because the restrictions there, they weren't nearly as strict as New York. And there's lots of old people that live in Florida. There's lots of nursing homes. And so what Governor DeSantis is doing there is very dangerous. It's very dangerous. It says here last week, I forget the two authors that penned this. It says, Florida doesn't look nearly as bad as the national news media and sky is falling critics have been predicting for about 2 months. But then the national news media is mostly based in New York and loves to love its Democratic Senate or governor, Andrew Cuomo, about as much as it loves to hate Florida's Republican governor, Ron DeSantis. You've heard this before if you've listened to this program. Governor Cuomo can do no wrong. New York is the worst of it, the epicenter of COVID-19. And he is held up as the star, the celebrity, the one that's handled the crisis the best. He can do no wrong, Mr. Cuomo. It doesn't matter how many thousands and thousands of New Yorkers die. He's handled it just perfectly. So say the media. Politico said, first, let's just come out and say it. DeSantis looks more right than those who criticize the Sunshine State's coronavirus response. It says, according to the latest Florida figures, fewer than 2,000 people have died and around 43,000 have been infected. That's a fraction. Listen to this. That's a fraction of the dire predictions made for Florida when spring breakers swarmed the beaches. Remember those scenes? Oh, the media, they were appalled. How could these people go to the beaches in Florida? Right as we're about to hit peak level of this pandemic. It says here, and those numbers are dwarfed by similarly sized New York, which has seen 12 times more deaths and nearly 8 times more infections. It says more people reportedly died in New York nursing homes than in all of Florida. That's actually an understatement. Something like 5,000 people, 5,000 Americans in New York have died in nursing homes as a result of COVID-19. Florida has less than 2,000 total. Latest figure right here, 1973, 1,973. In New York, 5,000 just in nursing homes. And then you know about the decree that Andrew Cuomo gave March 25th. We've got to clear out the hospitals. We need more beds. So send those patients, even if they're COVID-19 positive, send them back to nursing homes. And then that disease ravaged all of those elderly care centers. The nursing home massacre, as we've called it. Politico says here, the polling disparity. DeSantis is actually polling worse than Cuomo in their respective states. And the Florida press is wondering why. So isn't this interesting? Here again, the pseudo event tells us DeSantis is bad. Cuomo is infallible. That's the phony, fake narrative. The stats, the evidence, we hear a lot about science, right? Science, evidence, facts, data. Here the press in Florida, they're wondering, why is DeSantis polling so bad? And Cuomo he's never had higher ratings. Never. It says part of that is style. Cuomo has a smooth delivery, a deep and calming voice, and an attitude that projects he can answer any question. DeSantis sometimes comes across as peevish and defensive, has made a misstatement or two, and was mocked for struggling to put on a mask. But most of the difference between DeSantis and Cuomo is due to politics. DeSantis governs a politically divided state. Cuomo is a scion of Democratic royalty in a deeply Democratic state. And then added to that, you have most of the established media. They're situated right in New York, in the Northeast. And they are radically, radically left-wing, more so than many of the politicians that they cover. And they adore him. They adore Cuomo. Politico says, yes, there's media bias, too. Cuomo also has something else DeSantis doesn't. A press that defers to him, one that preferred to cover Florida morons at the beach, where it's relatively hard to get infected, over New Yorkers riding cramped subway cars, where it's easy to get infected. Have you seen all the images of the subway system in New York and the people? They're still open. And yet the establishment media will go on. They will go on and on. As soon as one beach opens, one beach. It's very similar to the images from last week, that smaller example I just gave to you. Here's the president. He's outside. Everyone's spread out. He's not wearing a mask. And then they get into the little cramped quarters in the briefing room, and Caitlin Collins pulls off her mask right after the briefing is over. She pulls it right off. It's all about the image. And then if they get caught, all that they have is 90,000. 90,000. How can you bring it up? They want to change the rules as they go. That's what makes it so confusing and for some people so infuriating. I remember when I was when our kids were small and we'd play board games every once in a while, and you know, they'd be competitive, and generally the parents would win. And this is always a challenge for a little 5, 6, 7-year-old. But I can remember my kids when we'd get halfway through it and maybe things were turning bad for them in the game. And then they'd want to say, well, the rule is this and this and this. In other words, there was a little change in the rules and they wanted it to benefit them. It was an excellent teaching moment for a parent. No, this is, let me get the rule book. Let's look at it. Let's see what it actually says, because we're all abiding by it. Then, you know, there's some board games where maybe it's a little confusing, or maybe if the group determines that, well, we're going to play it according to this rule or whatever. Fine. If you agree about it ahead of time, okay. But it has to apply to everyone all the way through. You can't change it midstream, and you can't have one standard for this group and then another standard for this group. But that's the way the media want it. That's the way they want it to be. You are not to judge them. You are not to criticize them. You can't say that they're fake because 90,000 people have died. 90,000. Look at the stats and the figures. Compare Florida with New York. What is the real scandal here? What is the real newsworthy event here? That would be the massacre inside of nursing homes, most especially in New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, the Northeastern Corridor. 5,000 deaths in nursing homes, at least just in New York. It says here, in fact, people can still ride the subways for most hours of the day in New York, but Miami Beach's sands remain closed. Does this make sense to you? Does this sound logical? To Caitlin Collins and her friends in the media, it's perfectly logical. This is just what we're supposed to do. Don't criticize Cuomo. He's done a fantastic job. It's DeSantis that really has botched things up. Well, here's someone at Politico who dares to tell the truth. It says, maybe things would be different if DeSantis had a brother who worked in cable news and interviewed him for a sweet moment in prime time. So they're all in it together. They're all related. The Democrats, the radical Democrats, and their activist friends in the media. These are not reporters. These are not truth tellers. These are activists. These are actors. These are individuals that want to present to you phony events, pseudo events, images. And it's also carefully framed. Even this program, any program, you think about the power that a presenter, a broadcaster has in even what's covered. We decide. We decide what we present to you, the listener, every day. And so do the people at CNN. And so do the people at Fox News and wherever else. I think of the Berean example in Acts 17. Paul came into town. He was preaching the truth of God. And yet he told them, like Mr. Armstrong used to tell us, you can't just take my word for it. You've got to carefully compare it to God's truth, God's word, the Holy Bible. And the Bereans did that. It says that they searched the scriptures daily to see if those things were so. Richard found an article from the Times about the care homes in the UK. When all of this news broke with New York, when was it? 3-4 weeks ago, we started covering this, talking about how that Cuomo gave this March 25th directive. And then the disaster that happened in the nursing home centers all across New York. And as we were getting into that a few weeks ago, and we saw the statistics continue to climb, the death toll, the death rate in the UK, even before there were any facts or even before the data came in, I was sitting there at Edstone going, I just have a feeling the same thing is going on here in the United Kingdom, here in the UK. So here's the Sunday Times yesterday. It says, about 5 weeks ago, the manager of one of my care homes called me. I'm being absolutely hounded, he said, because I'm refusing to take a resident back who has tested positive in hospital. Here's a case where it's COVID-19 positive. It says the hospital's discharge manager, followed by the consultant, had rung my manager at home on a Sunday, and both had said, you have to take them back. You have a duty of care to take this resident back. So maybe it wasn't a March 25 directive. Maybe it wasn't absolute law. But here's the NHF, the chief executive and the people working under him calling these individuals at their homes. You've got to take these patients back. We've got to clear out hospital beds. And this article talks about how the hospitals were trying to clear away 90,000 beds or empty 90,000 beds to get ready for the onslaught. And so then the massacre happens in the nursing homes. And the hospital beds are left empty. The Telegraph had a piece over the weekend about Neil Ferguson's garbage model. He released some of his formula, whatever you call it, for how he arrived at his estimates. 500,000 deaths in the UK, 2 million plus in the United States. And now you have all these other analysts and scientists looking at his model and saying, what is this? This is totally unreliable. Totally. And yet this is what is responsible for locking down the United States and Britain. But never mind any of these statistics. Never mind the science, the true science. Never mind the evidence. Never mind the facts. Just remember the image, and you'll see it every day. When the cameras are rolling, you see the image, you hear the image, you hear what you're supposed to do. It's happening every day. When we come back, we'll finish today's show with the commencement address from the Herbert W. Armstrong graduation ceremony just yesterday afternoon. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. Untold thousands of professing Christian ministers have, over the centuries, preached Christ. They have professed to be his ministers, to represent him. They have said Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, but they have withheld Christ's gospel. Thus, the vast majority of people on earth have been deceived by false gospels. The true gospel of God's coming kingdom is directly concerned with world conditions as they are, with human nature, its source and origin, with world evils, suffering, unhappiness, with world peace. It's concerned with government, with the reason present human governments fail to be the benefactors of their peoples they are supposed to be. The true gospel message that Jesus preached is about all of this and much, much more. This all-important subject is thoroughly explained in Herbert Armstrong's book, The Incredible Human Potential. The Incredible Human Potential reveals how men were deceived about the truth of the gospel, and it makes plain what the good news of the true gospel really is. There is no cost or obligation, and all of your information will be secure. Request The Incredible Human Potential today. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. You're listening to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show.
Douglas MacArthur was one of the greatest and most decorated soldiers in U.S. history. Some have even called him a military genius. MacArthur graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1903. And after that, he steadily rose in the ranks in the U.S. military and then saw some serious action at the outset, or really rather more toward the end of the Great War. During World War I, as a colonel in charge of the 42nd Division on the Western Front in Europe, MacArthur won the devoted trust of his men, and he distinguished himself as a brilliant and fearless military leader. In between the two world wars, MacArthur became the youngest superintendent of West Point and the youngest chief of staff of the U.S. Army. So this was a man of accomplishment, high achievement. Of course, most people remember him for his exploits during the Second World War. It was during that war that MacArthur commanded the Allied forces in the Pacific. And early on in that war, after a humiliating defeat in the Philippines, MacArthur made a daring escape to Australia, and before his escape, he famously vowed, "I shall return." 3 years later, he did return triumphantly to liberate the Philippines and to lead the Allies on to victory. It was MacArthur who presided over Japan's surrender in 1945 and even its reconstruction into a peaceful state. At the start of the Korean War in 1950, the 70-year-old commander was chosen again to lead coalition forces against the communist-backed incursion on the Korean Peninsula. MacArthur pushed for bold and aggressive action in order to stop the spread of communism. In Washington, President Truman favored a much more limited war, and this led to an epic clash between the commander-in-chief and America's most decorated and beloved five-star general. Truman removed MacArthur from his command, but the larger-than-life general still returned home to a hero's welcome. Douglas MacArthur's farewell address is truly one of the great orations in American history. His entire life, 52 years of that life serving his country in uniform, his entire life had been but a preparation for this singular moment. As MacArthur spoke before the assembled Congress on April 19th, 1951, an enthralled nation listened to his words
with unconcealed emotion. Americans everywhere were gripped by the power and the soundness and the sincerity of his address. During the speech, MacArthur said that he had been accused of being a warmonger, which was totally false. In fact, as MacArthur explained, he hated war. Nothing, he said, was more revolting than war. But once war is forced upon us, there is no other alternative than to apply every available means to bring it to a swift end. War's very object is victory, not prolonged indecision. And after that statement, Congress rose to their feet and applauded the five-star general. In fact, they applauded him 30 times in that 34-minute speech. He said one of the great lessons in warfare is that appeasement begets new and bloodier war. And then he uttered that unforgettable phrase. He said, "In war, there is no substitute for victory. In war, there is no substitute for victory." Think for a moment about the powerful spiritual parallel there is in that statement. The Bible describes our present world today as evil and says that the whole world is deceived. It describes Satan as this world's God. It says Satan is the prince of the power of the air. Herbert Armstrong explained in many of his writings that Satan fills the airwaves with his attitudes, attitudes of selfishness, vengefulness, impulsiveness, recklessness, negativity, deception, and violence. And we see all of these attitudes all around us, all the time. People have no realization of the tremendous power of Satan, Mr. Armstrong wrote. He walks about, the scriptures relate. He walks about seeking whom he may devour. Satan is the reason this present evil world is the way it is. He's the reason this world is saturated in sin and suffering from all forms of physical and especially spiritual disease. Now, God hates war. He is not a warmonger. But in this present evil world, a world ruled by Satan's army, spiritual war is absolutely necessary. This is why the Bible describes true Christians as good soldiers of Jesus Christ. Christ is our commander in chief. We, collectively, are God's army. Put on the whole armor of God. Fight the good fight of faith. War a good warfare. Overcome or conquer your adversary, the devil. Come out of and forsake the ways of this world. Crucify the old man along with its carnal, sinful nature. Destroy the body of sin. This is the language of the New Testament. Christianity in today's world is war And in this spiritual war, there is no substitute for victory. There are no other options except victory. Now, God has drafted you graduates to be good soldiers, and he's given you, all of you, a crucial role to fulfill in this good fight. He's equipped you with all of the instructions and the training that you need to be victorious, to be a successful military leader, in fact. He will lead you to victory if you trust him, if you follow him. As you heard earlier in the student address, this is just the beginning. Here's MacArthur. He had this 52-year career, this distinguished and decorated career in the U.S. military, and it all started for him at the age of 19. Well, really, you could say it was before that. He grew up in a military family, so really it was all of his life. But the formal education, it came when he went off to West Point as a 19-year-old. He graduated in 1903 at the top of his class, and he, you could say, made the most of that training thereafter. The active combat, the dangerous missions, the life-threatening missions, and the weighty, weighty responsibilities, all of that came after college. All of that happened after West Point. Yet those early years were crucial in his development as a young leader in the military. My father's made the point, and we brought this out in the Churchill class this past year. He made this point about 3 years ago at SEP, that Winston Churchill had a lot of disadvantages as a young man. He had a father that didn't love him. He had a mother that was self-obsessed. But he did have a loving nanny who doted on him. And my father made the point, and this was very encouraging, if you come from a background where there's some dysfunction. He said that if God can interfere in Churchill's life that way to help him along, to inspire him, think about what he can do for you. And it's interesting when you look at the lives of Douglas MacArthur and Winston Churchill, there's quite a few similarities. They both pretty much lived during the same time period. They both pretty much lived the same number of years. And yet there are some distinct differences as well. MacArthur came from a very different family background than Churchill. He grew up in a home headed by his father, who was a military hero. He won the Medal of Honor during the Civil War, leading the charge, I forget the name of the mountain in Georgia, but a daring raid. And his grandfather was a distinguished judge in Washington, D.C. So he came more from a prominent family. Churchill certainly came from a prominent family too, but there was not a lot of love in that family. In MacArthur's family, it was different. He revered his father, and his father loved him. His father said to his wife when little Dougie was 13, "I think there is material of a soldier in that boy." And Douglas overheard that comment, and it stirred him to action. This was like a turning point for him in his early teen years. He started to take his studies much more seriously, and he felt like it was a foregone conclusion that he was heading straight into West Point after high school. He never did forget that remark. William Manchester said, "No adolescent rebellion for him. All his life, he would seek to be a man at arms in whom his father could have exulted." He received enthusiastic support for this lifelong mission from his mother, who told him when he was young, "You must grow up to be a great man. You must be like your father," or Robert E. Lee, she was a Southerner. So he graduated high school in 1897, and coming from a prominent military family, he, as I say, thought he was destined for West Point. Well, at the start, he couldn't get, even though he came from a distinguished family, he couldn't get the government sponsorship. That's how it worked back in the day. And then added to that, he failed his preliminary physical examination. He had a curvature of the spine. So I believe his father was off on assignment in the Philippines, and his mother promptly moved him to Wisconsin, where she knew this congressman. She was in search of a congressman who would give him favor in hopes that he could then get acceptance into West Point. So he had a year or so to prepare, and he started to see this specialist, this therapist, physical therapist, every day for a year to correct this spinal defect that he had. And his doctor said of little Douglas, "He was one of the quickest fellows to obey orders I have ever treated. He was tremendously interested in anatomy, biology, physiology, and everything that concerned health and medical science." So in addition to his physical therapy, Douglas worked with a tutor to prepare him for this contest in his congressional district. 13 contestants, and the winner would take all. The winner would head into West Point. So every day for a year, he walked 2 miles to see this tutor, and the tutor was, I forget the subjects that he was focusing on, but he'd spend hours with him, and then he'd spend hours more at home with his mother, who tutored him in other subjects. So it was an intensive one-year course. And MacArthur said, "I never worked harder in my life. Never worked harder." On the day of his test, the night leading up to it, he was up all night. This never happened to him. Think of all the harrowing experiences he had in his life. He never had a sleepless night, except for that night before the big test. And his mom tried to comfort him and encourage him. She said to him, "Doug, you'll win. If you don't lose your nerve, you'll win. You must believe in yourself." He placed first among 13. He was far and away ahead of the pack, finishing in the 99% grouping. I think the second place guy was down in the 70s. If you look at MacArthur, or to take the Churchill example from earlier, so much of their success and their ability to lead in time of war was just simply because of their willingness to outwork the competition. In good soldiery, there is no substitute for thorough preparation and disciplined training. MacArthur said in the lesson that he learned leading up to that test, "It was a lesson I never forgot. Preparedness is the key to success and victory. Preparedness is the key." He prepared thoroughly. Going back to that farewell address in 1951, it was during that speech that MacArthur referred back to his comments, the comments he made in 1945 following the Japanese surrender on the battleship Missouri. And these are the comments that we're probably more familiar with because they're in that little booklet, "We've Had Our Last Chance." But he, in quoting himself from 1945, he said, "Men since the beginning of time have sought peace." Keep in mind, he's saying this right after World War II ended. He said, "Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. The utter destructiveness of war now blocks this alternative. We have had our last chance. If we will not devise some greater and more equitable system, our Armageddon will be at the door. This coming from a man who read his Bible nearly every day since he was a boy. This was a man who knew that unless the dangerous trend of world events was somehow reversed, human civilization was headed toward utter oblivion. He realized that man's misguided science and faulty human reasoning, it was leading mankind to the brink of destruction. He went on to say, the problem basically is theological and involves a spirit of recrudescence and improvement of human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advances in science, art, literature, and all the material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. He says it must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. It must be of the spirit. That's a remarkable statement. Coming from a man of the world, a military man, who acknowledged that to solve the problems of this world, we need a change in human nature. We hear a lot today about science, evidence, facts. And yet the facts and the evidence of these past 6,000 years of human civilization are clear. Man is totally incapable of effecting this change in human nature. It is impossible without God. The prophet Jeremiah said, "The heart of man, the mind, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it?" The educational system of today's world, incredibly, it looks upon the heart of man, the mind of man, as something that's basically good and trustworthy. It's just the opposite, isn't it? Students that come to Armstrong College are taught that human nature, in essence, is evil. But there is an opportunity for change, miraculous change, upon repentance and faith. Now, that's true education. That's unique. That's not taught anywhere else. In that same passage from Jeremiah, it says, "Blessed is the man that trusts in the Eternal and whose hope the Lord is, for he shall be as a tree planted by the waters." Blessed in the man who trusts God, who looks to God. Blessed is the man who changes his evil nature with the help of God's Spirit, so that we can think like God, so that we can act like God. In 1 Corinthians 15, I'll conclude with this passage. It's right at the end of chapter 15 in Paul's epistle. Verse 53 says, "For this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality." Only God has immortality. Only God can change our vile, corruptible bodies and minds. This corruptible must put on incorruption. Paul continued, "So when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, Then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Death is not the final chapter in a person's life. God's drama ends in victory. God's drama ends in eternal life. Toward the end of that speech in 1951, Douglas MacArthur, he uttered the phrase from an old song that said, old soldiers never die, they just fade away. And at that point, I presume, millions of fellow Americans fought back tears as MacArthur explained that he had tried to fulfill his duty before God. Think about our end or our destination as soldiers of Jesus Christ. It's never going to end for us. We're never going to fade away. The war will stop. God hates war. He hates it. And you know about the prophecies that speak of converting the weapons of war to farm equipment. That's coming, and soon. Verse 55, it says, O death, where is your sting? O grave, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law, it says, but thanks be to God, verse 57, which gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. That's the solution to the problems of this world. You don't solve the problems of this world by doing away with God's law. We solve it by repenting and then going forward with Christ. And that's the education that you receive at God's college. That's what you're learning. That's the one main point that you're here to learn. Paul said at the end of Romans 7, if you remember, he talked about how wretched he was and then asked, who's going to deliver me? And he said, I thank God through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Death, swallowed up in victory. As you go forward, graduates, think on this last verse in 1 Corinthians 15. It says, therefore, my beloved brethren, be you steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much as you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. Go on from here and abound in the work of God's church. That's what this education has been preparing you for. West Point is finished. But what about all the years of moving up in the ranks? What about hitting the front lines on the Western Front? Working in the administration, at the academy, chief of staff, heading up the Pacific, the daring escape back to Australia, and then the three-year march from one island to the next, to the next, to the next. And then victory. Remember, to be a good soldier, there is no substitute for thorough preparation and disciplined training. That's my take. That's a play on what MacArthur said. But then to quote him, on the battlefield, never forget that there is no substitute for victory. War's very object is victory. That's our goal. That's your goal. That's the destination. However long, difficult, bumpy, or narrow the road may be, victory is your aim. Victory at all costs. For without victory, said Churchill, there is no survival. Victory then, students, graduates of 2020, victory is your only option. Go on from here and claim multiple victories. To the courageous class of 2020, onward to victory.